Blog Talk Radio.
I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Are they in the house, on the outside, in this 112-degree weather? Everything is political in your life from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. And just because you've been a Democrat or Republican your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. But we here are going to bring you these people. We're going to let you talk to them. We're going to let you ask them questions. We're going to let you speak to them about what they're talking about. Are you still on your family's health care plan if you're 26 years old? Or as the Progressive Party says, Obamacare, which is now the law of the land. From the city, the county, the state, the entire nation, we're going to bring it to you. So sit down, get a pencil, paper, take this hour as a classroom experience, and we will make sure that you have the last word. It's June 29th. How about this week? How about this month? You know, everybody keeps putting the prez down. Well, let's see what the Chief Justice said. It is reasonable to construe what Congress has done as increasing taxes on those who choose to go without health insurance. Such is within the Congress's power to tax. Yeah, well, you know what? You fools out there that can't read and write, you Regressive Party people, because that's what you are. You keep dittoing that fat fool drug addict on the radio, Rush Limbaugh, and big head Sean Hannity and O'Reilly, who used to be a busboy at NBC because he couldn't get a job because he wasn't smart enough. You keep mimicking him and those people. That's why you don't know anything. Right now, you're paying through the nose every single time someone goes into the emergency room because they got a hangnail. It costs $250 average just to sit in there. And you're saying, oh, gee whiz, I don't pay anything on that. Yes, you do. That's why your insurance is so daggone high. I mean, you know, here in North Carolina, we have fault in car wrecks. It's somebody's fault. In New York, there's no fault. That means everybody pays. That's why the insurance is higher. Well, we need to have that with health insurance because we're paying every single time someone goes into the emergency room, whether you think you are or not. So if we get these people insured by putting them on this health care plan, it will go down in price. How could you believe it's going to go up in price? The fool from Texas. Texas! The lowest percentage of people that have health care in the country. They had the fool, the attorney general, on TV today. He said, we're proud that we don't have health care. We're proud. But we got more jobs than anybody. Yeah, more jobs making 5 cents an hour. They can't buy health care with their jobs. He says, yeah, but we don't want to take that money to have people have health care because we're going to do it ourselves. So the host asked him, when are you going to do it? He said, well, we have jobs. Yeah, but that's not the question. When are you going to give your people health care? I mean, it's just completely ludicrous. 19%. 19%. In, I believe it's in Texas, don't have health care who are making less than a minimum wage. They have, I believe it's about nine, I can't remember, I don't want to quote it because I can't remember the number, but they are last in health care. They are last in job creation that is full-time. They're first in part-time employment because you don't have to provide health care when you're part-time. And so this is what we're going into. And right now we have on the phone Mr. Marshall Harvey from Wake County, the Soil and Water Commissioner. Mr. Harvey, how are you today?
Fine, Mike. How are you?
So what do you think about the president's plan?
Well, I think, as the old saying goes, we landed one for the Gipper. I think it was...
Even though the Gipper never wanted it.
Even though the Gipper never wanted it. I think... I think it was great, and for once, we had some folks who we all knew the way that they were going to vote, but then there was one we didn't know. We did not know that the Chief Justice was going to vote the way he did.
Well, and, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, oh, he's trying to make up for when he screwed up, when he did the swearing out of the president. He's trying to make up for this stupid ruling, Citizens United. But people did not listen to this man. Now, may not have him all the time, but he said, my job is an umpire to call balls and strikes.
That's it.
He said, and this is when this right here is within the preview of the Congress to tax.
That's
now, the
true.
Reason why it's a taxable issue is that when people, you know, if you're living on an island by yourself and you got a car and all the gas you want, you don't need insurance because you're not going to run into and kill somebody else. But when you have health problems like tuberculosis and you're breathing down someone's neck in the subway, you can cause somebody else to get sick also. If you've got a plague and you're walking around the city, you can cause somebody else to get sick also. If you're taking up the seat in the emergency room and someone's coming in who's bleeding out, you're taking up the space also. So people need to pay for that. And if they want to say it's a tax, well, it is a tax. But it's deductible. Now, what do you say to that?
Well, I think you're basically right, Mike, that health care is an issue, particularly in America, more so than any other Western country. and we are the last people to try to get on board. Well, this is not going to be the answer or the panacea to the problem.
Of course not. Of
anyway,
course not.
But it's a start.
Well, you know,
and you have
gotta
to start someplace, the same as we did with Social Security and other Medicare programs that we started
rights.
For the
and
benefit of
rights.
Citizen.
And civil rights.
But we have a bunch of idiots in Washington and in Raleigh that can't see that issue. They can only see the issues of rich folks.
No, they can see the issue all right. They can see the issue. They just don't care about anybody else. They don't care. That's the problem.
Well,
they don't care.
You know, it's only for the rich that they are concerned, not for the middle and the lower income people.
Well, they're not even lower income. They don't care about the middle income people are the ones that are fronting all the funds on this. The lower people don't make enough money. We're hurt them. It's the people in the middle that are getting killed by people walking into the hospital and saying, yeah, I have no money. Take care of me.
Right.
We're the ones.
So.
You know, I just don't understand this nonsense that they will try to perpetrate that we don't need this. And you have an attorney general in Texas today. The host was even shocked. He said, we're proud we don't have health care. We're proud. I mean, that's what he practically said. He said, and then when he asked him, well, you know, your citizens are sick. Yeah, but they got jobs. He said, and we'll make sure they get health care. He said, well, when? What do you got on the board? Well, they got jobs. And if they're dying, the emergency room will take care of them. Well, that's why, you know, but the emergency rooms, they're sort of pushing them aside, too. You know what I mean?
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
it's just ludicrous. We have a couple of things today. We have, we're going to be talking about the, as I said, the Affordable Healthcare Act and the Medicaid provision put out Affordable Healthcare Act, which is going to be very important. You know, the states were talking about this yesterday. There's 26 states that don't want any part of this. 26 states that do not want any part of this. And why? Because those are the states where we have Republican governors.
Yeah, those 26 states are led by Republican governors, chief executive officers, and they're thinking along the lines of the other Republicans.
Well, the problem is that they don't want to take the money because they said, well, we don't want to take anything from the federal government. Well, they don't want to take anything from the federal government because there's a black man giving it to them in the federal government. That's the first thing. That's the top of the line. That's just what this whole history is about. It ain't about nothing else. It's about that there's a black man in the White House. That's all it's about.
Well, that's now, the issue, Mike. It boils down to one issue.
Of course. That's what the issue is. I mean, yeah, screw up people. Let them die. Forget it. You know, we got to get him out of here. We'll blame everything on him. When everything goes to hell in a handbasket, he's out of here. We'll blame it on him. You know, let's don't blame Bush, but let's blame it on Obama. Okay, you know, because he'll definitely get the blame for it. But the thing is, though, what are their people going to say?
Yeah, when they don't get the money,
when they don't get the money, and their people start saying, well, wait a minute, for the first 3 years, they don't pay a dime. The federal government pays 100% of the cost.
Mike, let's deviate for a second and go back to the Attorney General situation. You know that executive privileges that the president has, he did not invoke it when he could have, and he finally ended up doing it, and I don't think he really wanted to do that. But the problem with the whole gun tobacco was created by President Bush. And what this administration tried to do was to continue now to carry out the program. Tragically, someone got killed. But if that had not happened, we would not be talking about that. Now,
well, you see, yeah, but now, before you go on, there's a misnomer here because Kathleen Eben, who wrote an article in Fortune magazine, comes out and says they did not run this gun walking program. That's a complete, utter face ball lie. And she
that's a lie.
That's right.
They didn't run the program.
Lie. That's right.
She says that the
gun program was never carried out by these people in the ATF. The ATF was trying to get warrants to get these guns back from these people, and they could not get them back.
Well, you know, but the problem is that the House has censured the attorney searching for or prosecuting the attorney general. He's their boss, and it's very difficult for the Justice Department to do something against the attorney general. This has happened. If you go back and check the records, I think Bill Clinton invoked the executive privilege about 15 times. And it was not a big issue because he was white. Now we look at some of the other presidents. George Bush invoked the executive privilege just a couple of times, but the biggest case was Richard Nixon. Nixon invoked it around the Watergate issues. So you got a lot of issues here, and a lot of things that have been happening all along. But now it's become an albatross for this president because he's black, simply because he's black. If he was a white president, this issue wouldn't even be on the table. The issue of health care at this point, the care plan, the health care plan, would not be an issue. So if you look at the similarities that President Franklin Roosevelt had in trying to enact the Social Security Act was the same kinds of issue that we're facing with now. The same folks, only, you know, same type people were skeptical of that. At the time of the Social Security Act, we had nothing for people who did not get a pension from their company. And there were very few companies right. Back in the 30s when this was enacted that were offering pensions to people. There were people like the railroad and auto industry. They were offering pension, but very few other pension plans were there. So it was a kind of security blanket for the folks who were not offered the opportunity to have a pension. So
right.
the affordable health plan, and when we look at it, we look at all the countries around it. We look at Canada and how they are handling their health situation. I mean, let's be real. We are the leaders of the world. You know, we're the richest nation in the world, and we don't want to deal with our own people.
Coming in right now.
Okay.
Hello.
Yes, hello. I hear you.
Okay, hold on 1 minute. Okay, Marshall, we have a special guest calling in right now. And it's Dr. Garrett Adams, who's an MD, a pediatrician specializing in infectious disease and infectious disease epidemiology in Louisville, Kentucky. And he is also the founder of the Besheba Springs Medical Clinic, a comprehensive ambulatory clinic in the underserved community of Besheba Springs, Tennessee. And I am very glad to have you. We had a little trouble getting you on the phone, Dr. Adams, but welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My pleasure to join you, Michael.
We had on the line with us is Marsha Harvey, who's the Soil and Water Commissioner in Wake County, and we were just talking about the healthcare program and what do you think about what has been done so far with the healthcare program?
Well, it's I think we're making slow progress. We're a long way from getting what we need and what the people want and the people deserve, but I think yesterday was a victory for the people. Actually, we don't want to step backward, and we've made some progress, but in the end result, we're going to have to do a lot better than the options that the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act offer. This law, as helpful as it is, and indeed it is helpful in many respects, and I won't go into all of those now because I'm sure your listeners are certainly have access to some of that information, but it's still going to leave at least in the short term. We have 50 million Americans uninsured still up until at least 2014, and then after that, we'll still have another 26 million, and we'll have we'll have tens of millions who have underinsurance, what we call unaffordable underinsurance, which is that even if they can purchase some of these skimpy plans, they're not going to be covered well enough. And also, unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act will not control costs. So this is why the Physicians for a National Health Program, of which I am now the national president, has been for now 25 years, we've been advocating a single payer, that is government funded but privately delivered, national health plan, similar to what a better way to understand it probably is as improved Medicare for all, so that we don't start Medicare at 65, we start it when you're born, and we improve Medicare, improve all of the benefits of Medicare, and we can do that. And when we do that, we get rid of the profiteering that goes on now with the corporatization of healthcare, people that are making wealth off of sick people, creating wealth from sick people in this country. We can capture $400 billion at least, and that's enough to provide health care for everyone. So what the people want in poll after poll is a government-funded national health plan, plain and simple. I think that's where we need to go now. I think Mr. Obama knows this. He was a supporter of single payer when he was a state senator, and he still has said even recently that single payer is the only way that we can cover every citizen. So that's where we stand. I think it was a good thing, honestly, to support that the Supreme Court decided yesterday that it is constitutional. This was what I expected, but we need to go forward from here.
Well, you know, one of the things that you said about the government involved in the healthcare plan is only on the monetary end, and we
That's
keep
right.
getting fed this lie that the government is going to come in between you and your healthcare. And right now, right this very present, the insurance company stands between
yeah.
you and your doctor.
That's right. That's
and I was
exactly.
looking. I was looking at your testimony in front of the Senate for SB 430, and
yes.
and you spelled it out completely. The doctor doesn't call the Congress or call the Larry Kissel here in the 8th District. Say, listen, I got Michael Lawson in here, and he needs a TENS unit for his back. Can I get it? Who does he call? He calls the doctor. He calls the insurance company. The insurance company then says, no, he can't have it. So, I mean, what is so scientific and being a rocket scientist to understand that it's the insurance companies that are in the middle of this?
That's right. Well, you've got it totally, Michael. You hit the nail on the head, and they're blocking not only the insurance companies but all the profiteers who've made this into a investor profiteering aspect of providing health care. They're the vendors who are charging too much, and the pharmaceutical industry, for example, in this country.
Yes.
And the whole corporatization of health care in this country has got to go to take care of our people, and we're not doing right by the people. And the people need to know that and stand up and say, enough, enough, enough. We want and we demand that our government provide an affordable national plan for every single American.
Now, I was just talking with Marshall Harvey before you came on, and we were just talking about how every single time someone goes into the emergency room, it's money out of my and your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time. Because we're paying for it. We are paying. So when they say that, the insurance is going to increase, yes, it's going to increase, because right now we don't count that money that we're paying in taxes in the health care premium
mm-hmm.
that they're using in the hospital. So this was a something with Deval Patrick, who's the governor of Massachusetts, was speaking about today on a program. They said, well, you know, the insurance is right now the average percentage is 13%. It goes up, but it goes up 15% in Massachusetts. He said, well, yeah, because that's where it's going to be, because they don't count. We now count the money that is being spent by individuals who don't have insurance that go into the emergency room. But you see, so everybody's insurance might go up a tick, but it's not going to go any higher because it's going to be in a larger pool.
Well, and then, you know, with all of this, as you know, you saw my testimony to Senator Bernie Sanders.
And I want to ask you about that also, because it everybody needs to see this testimony. It was the most riveting testimony I have seen in front of a government committee. Matter of fact, anywhere.
Yeah.
It is. I'm going to put it on my website so people can go to it. I'm also going to put it on Facebook. Everybody needs to see this testimony, and it's not that long, so it's fantastic. But go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah. Well, it's the truth. It's the truth, and that's what we need to know. We need to speak truth to power, and that we shouldn't allow this to happen to our brothers and sisters. What's the difference between some of my poor friends up here on the Burspa Mountain where I am now and the people who are able to buy? We ration health care here by ability to pay, and it's a crime. It's a moral crime that we have allowed this to happen to our brothers and sisters, and we should not have it, especially in this country. And when we say the Pledge of Allegiance and we talk about freedom and liberty and justice for all, then where is it? And I say we have to start with health care, and if we can do it. That's the thing about this, Michael, is it's economically feasible.
Right, absolutely. Marshall, do you have anything else to add, doctor?
No, I think I like the doctor's conversation. I like what he says, and I think he's on point. We're not there yet, but we can get there, and it's going to take a while to get there, some years. Like I say, when we started Social Security,
yes,
absolutely.
It took years to get where we are now.
The Civil Rights Act wasn't done overnight. I mean, there was plenty of things that had to be added onto it, plenty of amendments.
That's very, very true, Matt. None of those programs were overnight programs, but
right.
I think that when we look at the health of the American people, that we have set up a hierarchy of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Only the rich can be served in our system. And if you don't have anything, you can't afford it, then you don't get the health care.
Mm-hmm.
We look at talking about obesity. Now, if you've ever gone through one of the packages that people get, the food that they get from the federal government, it's all high in fat.
Is that right?
It's all high in fat. The canned beef, it's a mixture of fat and very little lean. The milk is not skim or low fat.
Yeah.
So everything, the cheese is very high in fat. It's very good cheese, but it's very high in fat. So we look at all these things that we currently have in place and how they are actually perpetrated on the poor. And the poor are the people who have to use the emergency room. An example, a couple of months ago, I was messing around. I have hay fever. And it was on a Friday afternoon, and I was out blowing up leaves, and the pollen and everything got to me, and I started sneezing, and I burst a vessel up my nose. So I couldn't get to my primary physician. They were closed after 5. So I said I'll go to one of the healthcare places.
Care center.
At urgent care. And so I went to the urgent care, and believe it or not, they closed at 5:30 on Friday. So I ended up going to the hospital in the emergency room. Well, that was an experience that I had never had before. A lady asked me when I checked in, I said, what's your problem? I told her that I had a nosebleed and I couldn't stop it. I think I burst a vessel. And she asked the second question, do you have health insurance? I said, yes, I do.
You had a wallet biopsy.
I had a what? A wallet biopsy.
A wallet biopsy.
Yes, I did. And I probably was one of the few people in there that had health insurance.
Yeah.
But I was
that
not.
That had a wallet.
Yeah. But it was just the idea that there were people in there with little babies, people who had been hurt in some accidents, people who were working and got hurt on the job, and those kind of things that were there. So it was about 300 people in the emergency room that sat Friday afternoon. Well, I finally got served, and it was probably around 6:30 when I walked in. I got served around 9:30, quarter to 10, which then led to another experience. There was only one doctor working in the emergency room that night, and there were about 4 PAs working with him. And it was just a traumatic experience that I had. And I got left the hospital around 1:30 that morning. So if you have to, that's the only source of medical care, and this is what happens to be in with a lot of folks, that they can only go to the emergency room.
That's right.
Well, we pay for that.
That's right.
We pay for people to go to the emergency room.
And also, Mr. Marshall, what we have to keep in mind is the ones that we don't see, the ones that are staying home because they know they can't afford it. And even if they go, there have been bill collectors that go through the emergency room and start trying to collect the bills right there in the emergency room. That's happening now.
Well, Dr. Adams, I want you to speak to some of your testimony on the SD 430. Marshall, I want to tell you, my wife, who's an RN and specializes in gerontology and geriatrics, has a master's degree in it. She now works at the VA and whatnot. She was listening with me on the computer, and she had a hand on her mouth because of what the doctor said about some of the people in Grundy. Is that Grundy County?
Grundy County, Tennessee, yeah. Grundy County.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's actually where I am right now as we're talking. I was introduced to this little community as a baby. My parents and my family have been coming up here for summer vacation for some six generations. And I've gotten to know some of the local people. And when I really understood the situation, then I thought, well, you know, they need help and I'll have to do what I can. And so a year and a half ago, I opened up a free medical clinic for the people, and I've gotten to know the people, and I know what's going on, and I see people like Michael's talking about in the testimony I gave for Senator Bernie Sanders in September. But I had four patients. He asked me, do you know of patients of your own experience that have suffered as a result of not being able to pay for health care? And the title of his hearing was, Is Poverty a Death Sentence? And I said, yes, Senator Sanders, it is. And I told him about four patients that I knew in Louisville, and I told about eight patients from here in Grundy County, the poorest county. Maybe it's the next to the poorest this year, but also, you know, along with poverty goes bad health outcomes. The one that I can hardly relate without choking up, I'll tell his name. He's dead now, and his wife has given us permission to tell the story. His name is Clay Morgan, and Clay was a successful mechanic. He owned his own auto repair shop. One friend of mine went to it up in Henry County, Kentucky. And he had melanoma, and he was treated, and he thought he was doing pretty well, and then it came back on him. He was bankrupted, had to sell the business, and then when it came back on him, he just went out in the backyard, took his own life because he couldn't. He knew he couldn't afford it, and he didn't want to bring more medical debt on his family. So that's the extreme. And then there was another, one young man who was a school bus driver in Louisville, and the insurance company denied his liver transplant, and we started raising little public awareness about it, and we were able to put pressure on the insurance company, and they finally relented and gave him his transplant, but it was too late, and he didn't last long. And then the third one from Louisville was a young woman that I knew, actually. She was a paralegal. She had a good job, and she got leukemia, and she was in MD Anderson Hospital in Texas waiting for a bone marrow transplant, waiting for actually insurance approval for her bone marrow transplant. Well, she was in remission, and she was waiting, and they wouldn't approve it, and she died because the insurance company wouldn't approve the transplant. So that's three cases just right there.
Doctor, I want you to say, because in a minute we're going to get Dr. Grace Lame, who's joining us, but I wanted to want you to talk about this because you had mentioned something that I found so profound. 7,000 to 1 is the ratio of people or patients to doctors in Grundy County?
Yeah. Right.
That's not as good as third world countries.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, you don't have to go to a third world country to do mission work. You can come right up here. And you can that's why I don't know if you've heard of remote area medical out of Knoxville. Have y'all heard of that?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure Dr. Lamb has.
And can't think call his name right at the moment, but Stan Brock is the man that has organized this, and he goes to various places, mostly Appalachia, and he'll open his clinics the people start lining up Friday night by 3 o'clock. They'll start lining up, and then they'll start calling numbers at 6 o'clock, and they'll see them right up until Sunday afternoon. And they still have to turn thousands away, and they provide dental care and vision and general medical care. And when you see one of those clinics, and in Los Angeles, I think they had to turn away 12,000 people. It's the people that are suffering, and that's what we need to keep the focus on, that Michael. That's what, you know, people talk about costs. They talk about all the constitutionality of the law. We have a law on the books, or at least a resolution that could become law, which is House Resolution 676, Congressman John Conyers from Michigan has been in the Congress, and it's reintroduced in the 112th Congress. The Progressive Caucus in the U.S. Congress is for this. We've made presentations to them. And this would accomplish what we need in this country. It would bring us up to the same status with all the other developed nations. We're way down at the bottom, number 37, according to the World Health Organization. And by any measure of quality, of a general efficiency of a health system, we don't rank well. We rank way down. And that's just not America, and it's hurting us economically, and it's hurting the people. It hurts the people one by one. 45,000, maybe 50,000 Americans are going to die this year because they don't have health insurance.
And that brings me to Dr. Adams. I have on the phone with us Dr. Grace Lynn Galloway, who goes and runs her fingers to the bones at some of these free clinics across the country. And Dr. Lean, can you talk to Dr. Adams? Do you have any questions to ask her?
I don't have any questions, but I do have a comment, and that is I'm thrilled and gratified that there are doctors like you in America, and you actually espouse everything that I've been saying. I hear people say, oh, they're going to Haiti for a mission, or Africa,
mm-hmm.
or India, or someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And I say,
mm-hmm.
Hey, you don't need to go overseas. Stay
mm-hmm.
right here. We have missions right here. I got some missions right here for you. You know, come on up with me to Appalachia and take a look at some of the people up there who only bathe in the summertime because their water source is the stream, and they're not going to bathe in the winter because it's too darn cold. So, you know, come on, come and see these people. Come and see my patients who have for $1.25, they can get 6 packets of ramen noodles, and that's their dinner. And we're going to tell them they need to eat vegetables, fresh fruit.
You understand, don't you, doctor?
I certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly
But you know what? This is what I want to say, and I think you all will understand this. A friend of mine said, what we need to provide in this country is not charity, but social justice.
We absolutely
not charity,
do.
But social justice.
And I think
that's what it's about. And I think the people need to know, like Michael Lawson pointed out, that it's the profiteering that's in the way. It's the privatization of healthcare delivery. We need to put patients ahead of profits. We need to get investor-owned health facilities out of the United States. So so that we have, we actually provide health for our own. We do it ourselves without making them profit centers. That's just plain wrong, to make a sick person a profit center.
I completely and absolutely agree.
And you know, I do not no longer get my drugs from here. If I check the price at Medco, and if it's still too high, I call the Canadian drug company and order it from there.
Yeah,
because
sure.
It's cheaper.
I
have a cousin, my first cousin in Canada, in Toronto, says that she would not give up her health care plan if someone gave her a new car. So what are we, these people down here, talking about?
Yeah.
Well,
it's all about profit.
We've got idiots that are, by the way, who are saying they're going to move to Canada because the Affordable
right.
Care Act was upheld by the Supreme Court. They're going to move to
yeah.
Canada. And I say to myself, do you guys really even think about what you're saying? You're moving to Canada? No. They're moving to Canada in protest of the Supreme
yeah.
Court ruling.
That's the line
they're
giving.
Is it how stupid that is?
That's the idiocy that we are dealing with. That's the kind of
yeah.
mentality that
yeah.
we're dealing with.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They don't understand. They haven't read anything. They haven't done any of the necessary things that one needs to do before making such a statement.
Yeah.
Right.
But see, now look, I want to put this to each one of you. How do we get this across to people who have to work 3 jobs a day
to
keep up with the rent?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do not have time to listen on the radio or
right.
watch CNN or
right.
MSNBC
right.
or even Fox News. How do
right.
we get this across to them? Look, this is going to help you. How do we get it across to them?
Yeah. Well, that's a $64,000 question.
That certainly is, yeah.
I had the opportunity to go two Saturdays ago. I was in, on a Saturday morning, I was in the Shawnee Presbyterian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, in the west end of Louisville, which is predominantly African-American. And we had church leaders from a half dozen or so churches there. We had breakfast together, and then I talked to them about national health care and why we need it. And they listened to the message. They wanted to know. And I gave a couple of them a couple of books. One's called Hijacked, which tells how the insurance companies took the best ideas and hijacked them and got their own law passed, which is what the good things, don't misunderstand me, the good things in ACA, but to keep the insurance companies in it is what's the basic wrong with
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, education. And I told these people, I said, you know, we're not going to get there if you don't help. We're not going to get there without you. And so it needs to come from the people. We've done people movements before. You know, we abolished slavery, then we had the Women's Suffrage Act, and the women could vote, and then we moved on into the civil rights era, and I want to see a movement for the people to claim good health care for themselves. We have to do this ourselves. We have to tell the politicians, we have to support the politicians that want single-payer health care. Senator Bernie Sanders, you mentioned Michael, and he
yes.
just said yesterday in his statement after ACA that we need single-payer national health care.
We do.
And there are others, you know. There's some in North Carolina. There's some in Tennessee. The Congress people, when they come up, I met a young woman in Chattanooga who's
mm-hmm.
going to Dr. Galloway, who'll be a wonderful congressperson if she can be elected.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, we have a we're sort of you know, between the light and the dark here, because we have to get the so-called blue dogs elected in order so we control the committees, but yet those same blue dogs don't go along with the health care plan. So you know, what do you have to do to convince them? And so, we're between a rock and a hard place in a few of these positions.
Well, you got to primary the blue dogs and get in progressives. That's my whole philosophy. Every election is a referendum. It's a referendum on every single elected official. If they don't do what we ask them to do, what we send them to Congress to do, then we vote them out. We voted them in, we can vote them out. And that's the way we have to do it. That's how we cleanse. Okay, and we can either do it that way and have our own people movement, or we can sit around wringing our hands saying, oh, what to do, what to do.
Right.
I'm an activist. I believe that if I work very hard to get you elected and you don't do what you promised me you're going to do, then I'm going to work just as hard to remove you.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Adams, what is the PNHP doing across the country to help point us in this direction a little more forcefully towards single payer?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're doing our best to educate, and we work with physicians. We've seen an increase in the number of physicians that support a government-funded national health plan. From 49% in 2000, there was a random survey of 5,000 physicians, which was done in 2002, and 49% at that time supported government-funded National Health Service. And then we repeated, or at least the scientists that did this survey repeated the survey in 5 years later in 2007, and then they published their results in 2008 and went from 49% to 59%. So in point of fact, and people need to know this, 59% at least in 2007, and I'll bet it's even higher now. It's
up. That's just the opposite, though, that the Progressive Party is saying that it's 65% don't want this.
Well, this is a peer-reviewed published article in the Annals of Internal Medicine. It was done out of Indiana University. And
so these are doctors you're talking about. You're not talking about
patients. I'm talking about
doctors.
Yes.
We see now. So why don't the doctors tell their patients? I mean, the doctor's job. You know, if you look way back from the very beginning, the doctor's job was not just to fix your physical ailment. The doctor's job was to be a philosopher. I mean, your doctor's job was to tell you how to bring up your kids. The doctor's job was to help you across the street. You know, we seem like we lost some of that along the way.
Oh, you're right. I know. It's so sad.
I mean, if you look at Gunsmoke, you know, hey, well, what was the doc doing? The doc was helping everybody in the town. He was helping the drunk. He was helping the gunslinger. He was helping the marshal. And not just with medicine. I mean, the idea of a doctor is to do no harm.
Yeah.
And we need to get doctors who, you know, I love this doctor. My youngest daughter, when she was born, I'll never forget, it was Dr. Berman in New York City. And my wife, who was a nurse, she did not like him. You know, but she said, he's great. You know, I loved him because he was this doctor. My daughter had she was 2 years old and she was coming down with a strep throat. There was 5 inches of snow on the ground. This was in January. This doctor, at 4 o'clock in the morning, his answering machine did not answer the phone.
Uh-huh.
He answered the phone.
Uh-huh.
And he says, bring her to the emergency room right now.
Yeah.
And I dug the car out, drove 15 miles to the hospital out in Long Island. He was there in his pajamas and bathrobe. As
well,
far as I'm concerned, he could do no harm.
Yeah. Well, there's some of us that still have that philosophy, but it's getting awful hard. But you know, one of our friends, now you ask, what do we do? We provide a place where people with the mindset that Dr. Galloway and I have, where we can be together and we can talk to each other as an organization, the physicians for our national health program, and we meet once a year, and then we also have conference calls every month. We had one last night. We have roughly 40 or I don't know, anywhere from 20 to 50 doctors from all across the country, and we talk about our program and what we can do. And of course, we've been planning responses to the Supreme Court announcement. But there's a spokesperson for publicly funded national health insurance, the physician's plan, in every specialty in every state. And we try to work with the doctors. I'll be going to Chattanooga in November to give a grand rounds to the Department of Pediatrics there, and I was in Johnson City and Bristol and Kingsport in May. In April, I was in St. Louis. We're having meetings now in Philadelphia right now. So we try to get the word around, and we try to write letters, and we talk to in Louisville. We have an organization, Kentuckians for Single Payer Healthcare, and we'll go anywhere and talk anywhere. And the word gets out. It gets out, and it's so much more now than it ever was before. I've been talking too much. You all, I should let you all.
It is such a pleasure to have someone who, first of all, knows what they're talking about. That's the first thing, and has been through the wars, as I like to say. You have in your testimony, you also mentioned about that in Grundy County that 2/3 of the school children were on free lunch.
Yeah.
And 19% were illiterate.
Yeah.
That's a reason why you don't have people realizing what they actually need.
Right.
But the thing is, the 7,000-to-1 ratio to doctors, is that because they can't get paid while they don't have doctors there? Or what do these 7,000 or these 6,999 other people do?
Well, one of the reasons that I founded this clinic was because there are small for-profit hospitals scattered around in the region, and they are owned by larger corporate health
insurance companies, right?
They can't go, our people can't go to these places without running up a huge bill. And then the collection agencies start calling them, and they just stay away. I saw, you remember this, from the testimony, a woman hadn't seen a doctor in 20 years.
Right.
And she was in bad shape. She was in bad shape. And we see it all the time. Every patient I see up there, nearly every patient has a cost issue. You know, they can't buy their medicines. They can't afford the lab tests. We had one patient that we were able to help. She has bad rheumatoid arthritis, and she had a doctor, a rheumatologist, in fact, but the lab tests in the doctor's office were so expensive that she couldn't afford them. So we were able to do the lab tests for her, and then we provide those results to her specialist. So that was just something that we could do, you know. And but it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't. But education now, isn't that what you're talking about?
Education, absolutely. But you know, but I also see these commercials on television where the pharmaceutical company advertises, if you can't afford this medication, call us. We have people standing by that will help and get you the medication.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Yeah, but that's good because they're saying it on TV, but that'll make it so.
and I don't know if they're going to. If it's a medicine you need for the rest of your life, I don't know if they're going to give
correct.
It to you
that's right.
For the rest
that's
of your
life. Is it cough medicine or is it diabetes? You know, there's a different story. But I know I don't want to take up much more of your time because I know you've been so gracious with us to be here. But I wanted people to hear you and try to understand how important that this healthcare program, the Affordable Health Care Act, is the stepping stone only to where we need to the direction that we need to go.
Yeah,
that there is
you.
So much more that we right. need to get to. But you have to crawl before you run. Nobody comes out of the womb and does a Jesse Owens down the block. So
right.
we need to build on something because
right.
today's world is coming at us so fast.
Yeah.
People can't disseminate all the information, so they need small baby steps to. And I know with the baby steps, people are going to die. That's going to happen, but. It's not going to happen in the Congress that we have now unless we go the baby steps.
That's right.
I just want to thank you for your time, and I want you to come back on the show. I'm going to call you.
Okay.
And I want you to come back on and tell us where you're at, and I want you I believe I sent you my email address. I want you to send me information so I can put it on my Facebook page. And I'm working on a new website now where I can get this information put on my website. So any information I spoke to, I believe it was Mark, in the communications, and
yes.
I'm also going to give Mark a call to make sure that the information that what's going on with the physicians' national healthcare plan, we know
right.
and we can update everybody.
All right.
Which is very
all
important.
Right.
I really appreciate that. Marshall, do you have anything else closing to say?
No, I've enjoyed listening today, Mike. I can now go and talk with my groups and have a little more information for them. It's been very, very interesting today. The show has been and informative.
Thank you very much, sir.
And I want to thank you, Dr. Adams, one more time. Marshall, you stay on. And Dr. Adams, thank you once again.
I'll just mention two websites, pnhp.org, pnhp.org, and also Healthcare Now. Healthcare Now.
Healthcare Now. Okay. Are there any, first of all, let me ask, since I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, are there any physician network doctors here? Yes, in Charlotte?
Yeah. Jonathan Koch, Kotch. I'm not sure just where he is, but we had just last night, just a minute, there was a woman from... I think I made a note from here. Let's see. Oh, I didn't write her name down. But, you know, the American Public Health Association met in Charlotte for 3 days.
Oh, is that right?
And, and so there were a lot of people PNHP people at that meeting. In fact, they had a reception. They had 30 or 40 there of PNHP members who met together in Charlotte. I know how you can find it. If you go to that website and there's a sidebar that says states, and go to states, and then it'll show you North Carolina, and you'll get a name and a telephone.
That's under PNHP.org?
Yes, yes.
Okay, good. We will do that then. I matter of fact, as soon as I get that, I will put that website, a link to that web page, and people can go there and see their doctor that is part of this program. And what we need to stress, we need to make sure that people get out and start stressing. See, because, you know, I was hoping, you know, and I said to my wife, you know, it might be good if the Supreme Court cancels everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we'd have to go to a single payer.
I know. You're right.
Well, it'd go directly there. But see, you know, does the need of the many outweigh the need of the few, or is the need of the few outweigh the need of the many? Are we going to sacrifice all these people that would be on the program to look down the road to see for something that we might get 5 or 6 or 10 years from now? Meanwhile, all those people would be in terrible condition. So it's better that it went this way. Well, at least we have these people covered.
Yeah. Yeah, we got something.
Well, yes,
we just
got
have
something.
To keep working on it. And people like you all helping us to spread the word, and we appreciate you very much.
No problem. Anytime.
Enjoyed talking to y'all.
You just call me anytime you want to come on, and I'm going to be calling you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Okay, you
bye.
Too. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Dr. Garrett Adams, the president of Physicians for a National Health Program. And I want to say thank you to him for he was only going to be on for 15 minutes, but, hey, what can I say, Marshall?
I tell you, he had some very good information, Mike.
Absolutely. And I know Grace had to go back to work, so that's why she had left. But there was some things here that I'm going to put that the link to his testimony on my Facebook and send it out. And the people in Grundy County, I just could not believe that this was not a third world country. I mean, the median income, household income, $25,000, but two-thirds of the school children, as I said before, have free lunch. 19% are illiterate, and a 7,000-to-1 ratio patient to doctor. Now, that is just unbelievable. And as I said before, this is the problem. How do we get this information? You know, I'd be so cynical sometimes. You know, I go when we were having the voter registration drive, and I sometimes would just stop in the street, walking down the street, and say, "Did you vote today?" He said, "Vote for what?" I said, "Well, it's a primary election." I didn't know. How do people not know, even by accident? But they don't. They don't know. They don't know what's in this health care plan. They don't know how it's going to help them. And that's a major, major problem. Marshall, what's the answer to this?
Mike, you know, that's been a problem of getting out the positive. Negative information get out very easily. Positive and truthful information has a very difficult time to get itself around the country. everything negative has a way of attracting people more than the truth does. And it's also in the messengers. The messengers sometimes, and you alluded to one earlier when you were talking about the commercial on TV and radio about if you need need your medication.
Right. You've seen that before, right?
Well, yeah, I've heard that several times, but I know people who do need medication, and I have referred people to that number, and they said, well, the people come back, they said it can't help me. So, you know, what do you do? What do you do in cases like this? You know, that you hear information, you try to disseminate it among people you think that needs it, and it goes no place. So I don't know. What are we doing here in America? What are we doing? What are we doing to each other? I think that we used to be a great country in giving each other a helping hand, but now we're not doing.
Oh, don't even go there. We used to be a great country. Oh, you're gonna get people cutting you up for that. Ah, oh, man.
We used to, in the area of being helpful to folks who needed it, and we don't do that much anymore. We are afraid of each other. You know, and that's a very tragic thing that's happening in this country now. And I think we're as a country or as people who live in America, we need to be more in tune with our neighbors as we used to be. But today we are afraid of our neighbors. We don't even know our neighbors. We don't make no attempt to know our neighbors because I guess it's the fear as to what would happen if I'd really got close to my neighbor. You know, what would they come over and visit all the time? You know, those kind of things are what are they all about? What are they doing, you know? So I think that we might want to go back to some basic, and that is teaching our young children that it's okay to help people. It's okay to be willing to help people. I became a social worker primarily, Mike, because I've always wanted to be helpful to people.
Oh, so you're not a community organizer. You're a social worker.
I'm a social worker. I'm not a community organizer. I'm a social worker. If you were a community organizer,
you could be president.
Well, I don't necessarily want that job. As a young person, once, you know, dreaming, I said, I'd love to be president. But now that I've seen how they're treating the current president, the African-American president, I think he's a very strong man because I think I would have lost it by now.
Oh, man. Are you
and really said some things to people that probably should never have been said in public to folks. But I admire him. I admire him. Now, I have done some community. That was my major. My concentration was community organization, and with another one in geriatrics. I heard you said your wife was a geriatric nurse.
Yeah,
well, I studied geriatric social work under Dr. Charles Bussey over at Duke University. But that whole idea of helping people in our society today, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. We have a few people that we communicate with, and we stay within that group. We don't venture out to other folks.
Well, you know, this is so unbelievable. When I grew up in a middle class neighborhood, upper middle class neighborhood, and we were the only African American kids. My brother and my cousin. There were just two families living in this neighborhood. Italian and Irish families, and we went to Catholic high school and we played baseball. We all got along. There was never a problem. I never knew the people. I mean, where we had houses, you know, we had small front yards. They were next door to one another, but I didn't know the people per se. Some I didn't even know their last name, but you know, if I did anything in the street outside my house, they would yell at me, when your father gets home at 6 o'clock, I'm telling them what you did.
I remember they would tell me,
"Well, he don't know my father." My father come and said, "What'd you do?" He said, "I'm coming out of the block. I'm coming to work. I don't want to hear none of this." "Oh man, forget it. That's my butt and my brother's." Of course, I only did it once. My brother, he did it every day. You know, if it was Tuesday, it was time for him to get a beating. Because my father would say to him, "It's Tuesday. Where's Dennis? Time for him to get a beating, because I know he did something." But me, no. One beating's enough. But the thing is that what we're talking about, it's because of how we now perceive things. How do we perceive things? We perceive things now for what we see. We see with our eyes. We see on television. There was a television show that just started last Sunday called Newsroom on HBO. And I want to tell you, it was one of the most profound first 10 minutes of a show that I've ever seen. And the whole show was great. But I don't know how they can do any. They don't need to do another show after they did this. And this this whole thing, it's, you know, I said to myself, you know, I can't believe I'm actually watching this, because this is such perfect timing. You know, it's about what are we here for? You said before we're not as good as we once were, and that was a question that one of the characters asked the leading character in the story. Are we as good as we once were? He didn't want to answer the question right away. And finally he said, "No, we're not." He said, "That's because of you out there, because you're not doing what you need to do. Everybody is not doing what they need to do." He said, "Do you take personal responsibility for yourself?" He said, you don't care what the Constitution says. Do we live under a dictatorship? Do we care about, are we living under socialism? Nobody cares. And half the people don't know what a dictatorship is or socialism. They call Barack Obama a dictator. They call him a socialist. They call him a communist. They call him a theocrat. Well, you can't be all those things.
No, he can't.
You know, so people throw words around like it's just they mean nothing, and that's because that's what that regressive party, starting with the Rush Limbaughs, who's really the president for the regressive party, throws around, because he knows the people who listen to him have low IQs and a low information voters, and they throw around this crap that just says anything that comes out of his head that sounds like it might make sense. And right now, you know, I think the character in the story says, we're like Japan is number one, and we're at 82. The as far as how living conditions, we're horrible infant mortality. We pay the most money for hospitalization. We have the best doctors and the best technology in the world. Why are we paying so much money? We're paying medications that should have been out the pasture for almost like a penny a pill. But we're still being charged $5 for the same daggone pill. And you can go to just across the border, and they're paying a penny for it. Now, why are we still paying for the research and development of this pill? I mean, it makes no sense, because it's all about money. It's not about helping the people in this country. They can still make money. You know, well, what was the line in The Godfather? When Michael Corleone was down there in Cuba, and the old man came up to him, he says, "You know," he says, "we were all great He said, we were better than U.S. Steel. He said, your father and us, when we were running it, everybody made money. Well, during the Clinton administration, everybody made money.
Everybody.
Everybody.
You're right, Mike.
And he increased the daggone percentage rate for taxes to 39%. So you mean it's these people have gotten that much more greedier that they want to make more? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. It makes no sense at all. You know, it just drives me insane. It just drives me insane. The life expectancy in Japan is 82. The United in all of Asia, it says that the life expectancy has climbed as an average 87. United States is 78. That's the average age. Why? Well, we have the best doctors and the best health care in the entire world. Why are we not living as long as they do in Japan and in all of the rest of Asia? Why? I mean, this makes no sense to me.
Well, I think a lot of
us used to be number one. We used to be number one.
Well, yeah, we used to be number one in a lot of things. And, you know, but we have allowed ourselves to be victim of our own success. And with that, you know, we come up short. Our auto industry, we used to be the top of the world, you know, when we kind of invented the auto industry. But we let it slip away for countries that for years were using ox carts. But now they're at the top of the chart when you look at who's producing the automobiles and the better quality of automobiles. You know, we as Americans have allowed ourselves to get in this position.
Okay, but see, now that goes back to this thing about the greatest generation. You know, we're going to be the only generation. But our children that will not be as good off as we were. And they have a lot more to make them better off than we were.
Yeah, they do.
So whose fault is that? Is that our fault, or is it this younger generation's fault?
No, it's our fault. Our children, we provided more for them, but we gave them less instructions. We didn't tell them that they're going to need to maintain the things that we provided for them. I hear it a lot of times. I've heard it a lot of times that people say, well, I want my children to have more than I have. And your children do have more than you have. But along with giving them that, do you know that you didn't give them any instructions?
Yeah.
My wife, when she would go shopping for our daughters, she would never buy the name brand things. Kids wanted something. A few things we got at name brands, but it wasn't like everything had to be, I'm trying to think of one of those name brands when they were growing up. Izod. It didn't have to be that. As long as
right.
It was nice and it was presentable.
Right.
But we taught them the value of money, of how hard money was to keep and to hold on, and that you had to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you were rewarded on those bases. And they say,
yeah,
well,
right.
The little girl next door has an Izod shirt. Well, that doesn't mean that you needed to do an Izod shirt, you know. So it was kind of like teaching them right now. And I teach my granddaughter the same thing. She's now 14. And I teach her about giving back, giving to other folks, giving to things. She comes in and she says, well, Granddad is such and such. I said, well, do you want to participate? She'll say yes. And so I will help her financially to be able to participate in certain things. Even though her dad and mother can afford it, I think that that way I can get my teaching in to her that I'd like for her to know about what the way I'm thinking. But a lot of that today, Mike, we have our parents. See, Grandmama is only 26. And you know, Mama is Grandmama may be 38 or so, and Mama may be 26. You know, who knows?
Yeah, right,
but
right.
There's not that learning process now that you and I had. You talked about your brother. Well, I had a brother too. My mother would leave in the morning to go to work. She would always get my brother Frank, because before the day was over, she knew he was going to do something that he needed to, you know, to be scolded for. But
right.
That doesn't happen anymore. That kind of thing. And there was a lady in our community that did not work any place. She saw everything that went on during the day. And when your parent got home, she would come up the street, house by house, giving her report.
I tell everybody.
on what
she was the monitor.
Had. Right, right. And she, you know, and you think they didn't believe you?
No.
You know, you had already expressed how you felt about her some time ago. I don't like that old lady down the street. She's too nosy.
Yeah.
She's always in the other people's business. You know, no. But that was the kind of thing. For instance, I don't know if in New York, but Mike, you all may not have had a guy who had an ice man, an ice cart, and that you would chip ice off of it. But the guy would sleep a lot of times, and the horse that was carrying the cart would just keep walking down the street. And we, as kids, would get under the canopy and chip off ice big ice. But one day my cousin was on there, and he was younger than the rest of us, and he fell off and hit his head on the curb and knocked a gash in it. Well, this lady saw it, okay? And the first thing she said, I'm going to tell y'all mama as soon as they get home. So we had to look forward for her seeing her leave her house that afternoon when everybody got home and walked down that street to make her report. And if she was going to your house, you know you were in trouble. But we don't have that anymore, Mike. We don't have that kind of relationship with our neighbors. And if you talk to kids now, you may be subject to getting a good cursing out. Kids are not I won't say receptive, but they're not as respective to adults as they used to be.
Well, yeah, I remember growing up. Every Christmas we would have to give up one toy, my brother and I, to give to, there was a family pantry someplace, I don't know where my mother used to take it, and we had to give up one toy and give to them. She said, I said, why do we have to give them? I only had it a year. She said, yeah, but you know, you're not really playing with it that much, and there are kids out there who don't have anything. So every year we expected, we had the toy ready in November that we were going to give up. We just assume everybody else was doing it.
No.
Now that's right. They weren't. You know. And I remember there was one time I used to. I was the only one. Well, our family was one of the only ones in where we lived. There was some others, but one of very few that had a television. I was the only one in my class that had a television. And in the third grade, you used to have kids come over every Friday and watch television. And I told this story before on the show, and it was this little girl that I just loved with. And she was in my class, and I used to carry her books to school, and I used to go over to her house. She didn't have a TV, but she had a fish tank. So on Wednesdays, I would go over and watch the deep-sea diver blow bubbles in the fish tank. I thought that was fantastic. But one of the things is that I used to sit there with my mother, and that's where I got involved with media literacy. I was watching Captain Video. You remember Captain Video? And I wanted to be a video ranger, and so I got the Captain Video decoder ring. But I had to buy shredded wheat, and then you had to get tear off the box top fill it out, send it in, and you would get the decoder ring. I hated shredded wheat.
I was going to say, did you like shredded wheat, Mike? I can't
no,
believe.
No, I did not.
I don't know anybody who really likes shredded wheat.
But listen, my brother loves shredded wheat. My brother. But see, it wasn't it wasn't the ordinary. I think it was the double box or something like that. So my mother had to go out and buy this other box of shredded wheat. Sure, you had it in the house. I wouldn't eat. You know, I like Cheerios, Rice Krispies, things like that. But anyway, so she said, you know you don't like shredded wheat. If you get this shredded wheat, you alone, not your brother, you are going to eat this shredded wheat. I said, don't worry about it. I'll eat it. I need the decoder ring. I got that shredded wheat. She made me eat it every 7 days a week until it was gone. I hated that. I hated it, and I swore that I would never do this. She told me, she says, don't ever ask for anything that you do not want because someone's trying to sell you something. And that has stuck with me to this day. I'm telling you, I got that decoder ring. And the first message in the decoder ring was when I decoded it, it says, you're now a video ranger. And I said, that's all? Holy God, I thought it was something really secret. I thought I was a video ranger all the time. I'm watching them every day on Saturday. So anyway, the thing is that we ask for things sometimes that we don't need, but today's generation expects everything, and that is, just like you said, our fault. When I used to teach the media literacy in high school and in college, I would tell the parent teachers in the high school, I said, your kids do not know how to listen. And they said, yes, you're absolutely right. I said, but it's not their fault. It's your fault. And they said, what do you mean it's my fault? How is it my fault? I said, let's settle it. It's not really your fault. It's the grandparents' fault. And they said, grandparents' fault? I said, yeah, because why? Grandparents knew how to listen because they grew up with radio. And they had to paint pictures from the words that came out of the speaker on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So they learned what exactly a word meant. When Tonto said he was going over to the window to look, he would say, King of Wasabi, I'm going to the window to see if the sheriff is coming. And you hear him clunk, clunk, clunk across the window, across the floor to go to the window to look out. And you could picture that in your mind. Today, we are supposed to be visual. And everybody knows a picture is worth 1,000 words. So what particular word does that writer want you to get from that picture? It could be multiple. So we don't know. We don't know. And if we didn't sit down and explain that to our children, they're not going to know.
Well,
just like what you said before, we have not taught them.
No, we haven't. We haven't.
And the thing is that the imagination, today people wouldn't understand the Marshall Plan. They wouldn't understand of going to the moon and creating a NASA. They wouldn't understand the war on poverty because they could not picture that because it doesn't affect them. And this all changed when Ronald Reagan came in, when they started using the Ayn Rand theory of pull your own self up by your bootstraps, but it's every person for themselves.
True.
It is not every person for themselves. Not in the world. You live here with everybody. You're going to die here with everybody. You don't live on this planet by yourself. Somebody has to help you. Someone sells you your newspaper. Someone sells you the milk. Someone sells you your broccoli. You don't produce all this yourself. So we need help. And when we're now in the position where all we think about is ourselves. And that's a problem. And that's, matter of fact, getting back to the HBO film, that's one of the things they were trying to, I believe, they were trying to say about the greatest generation and where we're at right now as spoiled brats.
That's very true, Mike. Because it's almost what have you done for me lately? You know, everybody
right.
wants something. If you haven't, if you can't do any, if you're not going to do anything with me, why should we even be friends?
That's
you
right.
Know, you know, if you're not going to do anything for me, then I don't have any use of you
that's
being
right.
around
right.
me.
Because it's me. What can
me.
You do for me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what can you do for
me? And it's not what I can do for you. It's what can you do for me?
For me
first. That's right. That's what it's about. What can you do for me?
Yeah.
And when I and I see that in my children, they are not like that, thank God. But the thing is that I don't know, and I think I know I spoiled them growing up. I wanted them to have as much as I had or more within limits. But, you know, I'm looking at my grandkids now. They come over to the house, and my youngest daughter's bedroom, since she moved out, that's their room now. And that room is a mess. And normally I'm a neat freak. I got to clean up this. You know, I said, wait a minute. The first thing they come in, when they come in with 3 and 5 years old, they come in, they trash the room. Everything is out of the drawers. All their toys are all out. And then I'm every time they leave, I'm putting all this stuff away. I said, why am I doing this? They're already going to come back and do the same thing again. So I leave it out. I said, here it is. And they came back the first time. It was all left out. They said, Grandpa, what's wrong? I said, you asked me what's wrong? He said, yeah, the stuff is here. I said, yeah. They couldn't understand it. Why it was still out the same way it was when they left. And I said, now, you know, isn't that funny? They saw the difference. So they understood that there was a difference. And they were reluctant because they said, well, why is this room like it was when I left? They
yeah.
were very reluctant. So the thing is that we have kids today that it is not their fault. It's our fault.
Yeah, it's our
why
fault.
Why they're like
yeah, it's us, not them.
So what can we do about it? Now, that's another question.
And that's a good question, Mike. What can we do about it now? This generation call themselves Generation X. Mm-hmm. I don't like to hear them say that, but
yeah.
in my practice, I deal with a lot of young children. And
right.
I had a little girl once who was coming to me from... And we were trying
what
to get
age?
Her to deal
what
with
age
her
group?
Her image.
What age group? What age group?
She was about little girl was 12.
Oh, okay.
And we sometimes talk about what would you like to do or when you grow up what would you like to do. This little girl's response, and it really I've always remembered her response. This little girl said, "I would like to live to be 13." And
what?
I did not have a comeback for that one, you know. But your aspiration is to live to be 13. You're 11 or 12 now, but to live that life is no hope. There's no hope for life longer than 13. you know, what are we doing to our kids? What have we done to them? It's just such a lack of love for life itself in a lot of our kids today that really is frightening. That we can't get away from what those kids could be and what they could. And when you talk to them about their self-esteem and what life has to offer, they look blank. They look blank. You know, they really look blank. I don't think life is serving me anything. You know.
Well, you know, but see now that is sort of some of the stuff that Newt Gingrich said. That
yep.
These kids, you know, they don't see, they don't have any role models. They don't have any people that they can look up to. All they can look up to is drugs and guns.
And that has happened to a lot of our African American communities because when you were growing up, we saw a lot of African Americans that were their own entrepreneurs. They had their own businesses,
yep.
And everybody lived in a lot of us lived in our neighborhood. So professional people, we saw professional people. We saw the teacher. We saw the lawyer. We saw the dentist. We saw the medical doctor and the nurses and people. They lived in your neighborhood. But today, these kids don't have that opportunity to see these people until they're, number one, if they're in trouble or they're sick or at a hospital. It's the only time they see these folks.
So, but see, now, I didn't have them in my neighborhood because we were the only two family, my cousins and myself, my grandparents were the only two families, but they were all, my families were all professional.
Well, you saw them.
So
okay.
I saw them every day, but they were like immediate family. And then when we went out to other places, we saw them.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't like I missed them. I just accepted where I was. And I accepted, you know, I frankly didn't have it hard growing up. I mean, I can't imagine a time when I never got what I wanted for Christmas. I'm sure there was a time. I don't remember that. So I'm not going to be coming from the same realization as a lot of kids who came from a community and never left that community.
True.
Because they had no place to go once leaving that community.
True.
They didn't know anybody outside of that community. Now, those are the kids that we need to reach. Those who don't go outside their own environment.
That's true.
So it's not necessarily the environment you live in. And I think that's one of the reasons why we had busing. Was to take kids outside of their own community. Am I right? I don't know because in New York I didn't go through busing. I used to walk to school, but I imagine that's the reason why they had busing was to show kids, hey, there's another life outside that you can aspire to besides the life that you see every day in your own community.
True.
So true. You know, the thing is though that. If you're watching television, you can see the other life. We didn't. I mean, I grew on the cusp of television and radio. I mean, but today, you know, some of these kids, their parents ain't much older than them, so they haven't been outside the community either.
True.
So
true.
And you don't
they haven't
know
been
what
outside
you don't
the
know.
Community.
And so you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
So how can we get generations that have grown up within that own community to come outside that community? And because they're in that community, that does not mean that that's the direction you're going to go, because most of our people who live in these communities are doing very well with their kids, and their kids are doing well. We only see the ones they want us to see that aren't doing well.
You're true, Mike. There's a book that was written some time ago. It was called Tally's Corner, and it was talked about the kids in the Washington, these men who had grown up in communities within Washington D.C., and how their aspiration was to actually go back. Their only outlet, they went to work, but their only other outlet, social outlet, was they went to the corner and saw the friends that they had always seen all their lives. And they never made any inroads in society because they didn't know how. The only people they knew were the people who lived in that neighborhood. So they remain on that corner more than likely till they died. They didn't interact that much with their families because the corner was the primary outlet for them in their lives, was going back to the corner. And so that's what they did. But it's tragically that there are a lot of people who live in communities now who do not reach out or to their neighbors. Some people will tell me, say, well, I see my neighbor drive up, and I run inside the house. You know, avoidance. I don't want to see that guy. You know, I don't want to see
that. And what is the reason behind that? What is the reason behind that?
Well, sometimes, you know, people don't like to socialize, and they avoid people.
Yeah, but they'll go up and stand on that corner.
Well, they're standing on the corner, but there was a study done by the University of Chicago back in the early 30s. Dr. Cooley was the guy's name who did it. He did something called the looking glass theory, that, you know, there are three kinds of ways people see themselves. I see myself as I want to be. I see myself as others may see me. But the last one is I see myself as I really am. And a lot of times people don't really want to share that who I really am piece with you. So they avoid you, and that's one way that they can get out of sharing things with people, or even being friendly with people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. There are people, and if you could listen in to those street corners, you would swear that it was the United Nations discussing world peace because everybody knows everything.
That's true. That's true. That's very true, Mike.
There's nothing that they don't know. So you wonder why they don't go out and say this to other people.
They surely don't. They surely don't. I had an uncle, Mike, that worked in the White House back in the 50s. He was actually the a janitor, but his major job was to that he stoked the boiler in the boiler room and kept heat in the White House during the winter. And but Uncle Sam would come out of the White House.
Is this coal or oil boiler?
It was coal.
Oh man. Mm-hmm.
And he would come out in the afternoon and he was dressed with spats on his shoes, a derby, white shirt, black suit, black tie, and a pocket watch. And he would strut up Pennsylvania Avenue after work. And you would think he was a diplomat. Well, and he knew everything that allegedly went on in the White House.
Well, I'm sure he did.
And to sit and listen to him talk, and I was a little boy and listened to my uncle talk, said, gee whiz, he knows the president. Well, Eisenhower was president. He probably never saw Eisenhower up close. But to hear him talk, I said, I got to be like Uncle Sam. You know, Uncle Sam was right on it. He was the politician. He knew things. He carried himself in such a way, and he was always clean that way. We never saw him in his work uniform. And, you know, but he was one of these guys that left the corner or if he was on the corner, he was the center of attention because of the things he was saying or the tales that he was telling. And he would come over on some weekends, and he would, you know, we as little kids, we were spellbound. Here's this man that knows the president of the United States, you know, and it's my Uncle Sam. But he was a janitor.
His name was Sam, and he knew Uncle Sam.
And he knew Uncle Sam, you know, but we used to love to hear him talk because he was so informative as to what was happening in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, you know, President Eisenhower did such and such. President Eisenhower did such and such. He's going to play golf tomorrow, you know, and this is that, man. And he went on and on and on. But Uncle Sam was, I think he was kind of the catalyst that shaped some of my thinking about politics and things of that nature. Now, he was a Republican. Now, in my later years, he was a real staunch Republican. And he would always come with a tale. And when Richard Nixon, I remember him coming when Richard Nixon lost to Kennedy. Oh, he was highly upset. You know, it was just like they had wounded him.
Well, he was upset when Nixon lost to Kennedy, huh? Oh,
yeah. Yeah, he was upset. And it was just like, oh, man, what has happened to me now? What is going to happen to me?
But you would figure that he would have came over to the from the dark side over to the light back when the Civil Rights Act was passed.
Well, he never did. You know, because I guess he went on the same old philosophy that a lot of blacks did, that the Republican was the party of freedom because of Lincoln.
Right.
And we stayed within the Republican Party for a long time, and the Democratic Party was actually part of the Dixiecrats, so we didn't want to be a part of those folks. So
right.
So it was not until Kennedy became president that black folks move wholeheartedly over to the Democratic Party. So there was an evolution there. In what party African Americans, you know, we identified the Kennedy clan with the era with being able to have voter rights, civil rights,
mm-hmm.
you know, public accommodation. All of those things we attribute to the Democrats under JFK.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, the majority of us were Republican, and the Dixiecrats, who guys like Lester Maddox and all those guys, they were Democrats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you didn't want to be involved with people who were further suppressing you, so to speak. But then here comes John F. Kennedy, a liberal, a Catholic, you know, someone that we had not been accustomed to, and the things that were enacted under his name. Well, giving truth to truth, Lyndon Johnson actually signed the civil rights legislation of 1964.
He was the only one. I mean, it's just like Nixon was the only one that could go to China. Lyndon Johnson was the only one that could sign the Civil Rights Act.
Right. And he was a Southerner, you know.
That's right. He was a Southerner. That's why he could do it.
That's why he could do it. And, you know, it was just such a transition for black folks. And I say today that the Republican Party is the party to be reckoned with. I don't know, Mike. This has been an interesting year about politics. And when we look at our national politics, we look at the people in the House and the Senate playing games with people's lives, and that's just not right.
Well, I we didn't get a chance, and we'll have to save it for next week. I wanted to talk about the Fast and the Furious, but because this calling the Attorney General a liar is really gotten so far out of hand. There's one thing I want you and the listeners to listen to, and I thought of this when I started thinking about the outrageous, and it's all this racist rhetoric from Daryl Issa, and I wanted to play this particular piece from, you'll know the person's name as soon as you hear the name. Just hold on. Oop, didn't get it to play. What happened here? Didn't get it to play here. What happened? Nope. I don't think I can get it to play. So I don't think I'm going to be able to hear it. I thought I could get this thing up and running, but it doesn't look like I can get it to play. So, well, we'll have to get it for next time because I can't bring it up. For some reason, I thought I could bring it up, but it's not coming up. It's something very... now, let's see if this can play here. Where is it at here? Let's see. Where is it at? It's 2 minutes long here, but I don't think I can bring it up for some reason. I don't understand why it's not playing. Let's see. No, Eric, but please try again later, huh? Well, it's not playing. So but anyway, this Fast and the Furious is something that we're going to talk about, and we do touch on it in the beginning. The article is out of Fortune magazine by Catherine Eban, where they actually talk about how this whole thing was set, that we never, these people never lost any guns.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really a major, it's a crime just by the way they're presenting it. It's a crime. So, well, that's all we have time for today. And I want to tell you, Marsha, it was great. And we're going to make sure that next week, I'm going to get this up and running. But I want to thank you for being on the show today. And I want to thank the doctor. And I want to thank, Dr. Adams and Dr. Lamb and Marshall Harvey. And this has been The Last Word. And we're going to go out with one of my favorite theme songs. Henry Mancini. Peter Gunn.
Now,
this has been The Last Word.
I'll talk with you later, Mike.